Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show this morning. We want you to join us at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, or send us an email, talk@steinershow.org. We're going to talk about the battle in the U.S. Congress and other issues in the Middle East, but the battles in the U.S. Congress around whether or not we will ratify this negotiated treaty with Iran. We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of numerous books, her most recent, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer, and Dr. Stephen David, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. His most recent book is Catastrophic Consequences, Civil Wars and American Interests. And Stephen and Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Nice to be here.
So let me ask you both to, if you can explain, I'll start with you, Stephen David, the opposition to this deal that limits Iran for the next 10 years, that even it seems like a number of Israeli generals have said that it's interesting looking at going over the report they put out recently, there's hardly a mention of Iran or nuclear power other than to say that this might limit their ability to attack Israel for 10 years or develop this kind of weaponry. So talk about the opposition to this.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that there are strong arguments on both sides of this agreement. I mean, it's not formally a treaty. If it was a treaty, it would have required 2/3 vote of the Senate, and that certainly wasn't going to happen. The opposition is based on several factors. First of all, it's going to release a lot of money to Iran. I mean, there's some dispute as to exactly how much, but it's probably in the neighborhood of $100 billion, and Iran is a source of a great deal of mischief in the Middle East, and to be empowered with over $100 billion, some of that money may go to Hamas, Hezbollah, and therefore create greater problems for the United States and its allies. There are other issues, too. I mean, the inspections in the agreement are a little sketchy. Military sites can take up to 24 days to inspect, at which time Iran can presumably move things around and cover up some nefarious activities. I think mostly, I think what people are upset is that it legitimizes Iran as a nuclear power. I mean, when these negotiations began, the United Nations and others said Iran has no right to enrich, given its previous activities
in
hiding nuclear activities. At the end of 10 or 15 years, even if Iran adheres to the treaty, it will be prepared to break out and become a major nuclear weapon state. And that concerns a lot of people, and I think justifiably so.
Phyllis Bennis, what about those questions?
Well, I think that each of them has an answer that's been answered over and over and over again. First of all, this is an agreement about Iran's nuclear power processes. It's not about where it uses its money. It's not about its regional role. It's not about human rights. It's not about a whole bunch of things. It's about one thing. It's about Iran's nuclear power program. Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. It has a nuclear power program. So what, you know, just the specific things that we just heard about the money that's going to be released. Well, it's somewhere about 59 to 65 or so billion dollars. So, yeah, that's a lot of money. But the question is, what's it going to do with the money? We just heard from an Iranian official that was on BBC this morning saying, you know, we're in the middle of a five-year plan, and people are demanding that money be spent on a lot of infrastructure issues and other internal issues. I have no doubt that there will continue to be money going to the regime in Syria as well as to Hezbollah. But what's been clear is that even during the worst of the sanctions, when the people of Iran were really suffering, the government was still prepared to use that money to support their allies. That's not going to change, but it's not going to change the situation qualitatively. On the inspections, all nuclear sites are subject, and Iran agreed to this, 24/7, anywhere, anytime inspections. The ones that are not are any place in the country that somebody, the U.S. or somebody else, says, you know, I don't have any evidence, but I think that site is going to be used for some kind of nuclear thing. Then Iran can appeal it. There's this process, and, yeah, it could take up to 24 days. during that 24 days, that site is going to be under complete surveillance from the outside. They won't be allowed in. That's true. But if we're talking about nuclear anything, that's not something you can, you know, pack up and hide in the refrigerator. It's not something you can put in a jar in the garage. We're talking large processes here. So the idea that somehow a place that's been identified and is under complete surveillance at all times is somehow going to allow Iran to slip by is simply, in my view, a really specious argument. On the question of the legitimacy, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and as such, it has the right to a peaceful nuclear power process, to produce and use nuclear power for peaceful purposes. That means medical stuff, power, whatever. We shouldn't forget this was all started by when the U.S. had to convince the Shah, who didn't want to start nuclear power, because he said, we have all the oil in the world, why would we do this? And the U.S. convinced them that, no, it would really be good for you to have a diversification of your energy processes. And, oh, by the way, why don't you buy a nuclear power reactor from Westinghouse? So this goes back to the 70s under the Shah, and it's continued ever since. But the notion that the problem is Iran being legitimized, Iran is a legitimate signer, unlike Israel, which has nuclear weapons, not a nuclear power program, a nuclear weapons program, with 200 to 400 high-density nuclear bombs at the plant in Dimona. And while nobody in the U.S. government wants to talk about that, they accept the Israeli notion of strategic ambiguity. We will neither confirm nor deny that we have these weapons, et cetera, et cetera. The whole world knows that those weapons exist, and they are hugely destabilizing in the region. So the notion that somehow this is about we shouldn't be allowing Iran, which is a signatory and has signed on to the most intrusive inspection regime really in diplomatic history with this agreement, that somehow that's the issue, while the issue of the illegitimacy of Israel's nuclear weapons is simply a false argument, I think.
So before I ask a specific question about this and where the U.S. may be going and Congress may be going, I heard kind of a verbal response, a guttural response. Stephen, what were you responding to?
Well, the notion that Iran is a legitimate nuclear power already, let's be clear about a couple of things. First, Iran violated the Nonproliferation Treaty. Its enrichment facilities, Natanz and Fordow, were not disclosed by Iran as it was obligated to do as a signatory to the Nonproliferation Treaty.
Right.
But it was revealed through intelligence means. They were caught cheating, in other words. And yes, Israel is a nuclear weapon state. I mean, I disagree with Phyllis that it was destabilizing. I think, in fact, it's a very stabilizing factor in that it convinces its enemies that Israel can't be destroyed by military means. The difference, I think, with Israel and Iran is that Iran has openly called for Israel's destruction. Its leaders, its military leaders, its political leaders. I don't recall Israeli leaders calling for Iran's destruction or the destruction of any other state.
No, they must try to
Iran
attack it.
In a different category.
They haven't called for it. That's true.
But what were you saying, Phyllis? They have called
what? They just tried to attack it. They used the assassination of the nuclear scientists, and they collaborated with the U.S. on the Stuxnet, I don't know how to pronounce it, that computer bug to destroy it. So they just try to do it. They don't talk about it in the same way.
Well, it's different than trying. There's a difference in trying to destroy a nuclear weapons program and destroying an entire state.
That's true. And as far as I know, Iran has not attacked Israel, nor has it attacked any other country in the region.
But as far as you know, I assume you would acknowledge that the Iranian leadership has called for the destruction of
Israel. I acknowledge that the last Iranian president, who was defeated, did call for ending the Zionist regime. He did not use the language. As we know, this has been proven over and over again.
It has not been proven.
It's not a frame in Farsi to say called for the end of the Jewish people or the Israeli state or the Jewish state or anything like that. He called for the end to the Zionist regime.
Okay, well, even getting,
not a, well, I have no doubt that he is a terrible
by
person,
many translations, talks about Israel
anymore.
Being wiped off the map. But
so,
he's gone.
But he's gone.
But the present leadership has called, Khamenei has said Israel is a cancerous tumor that must be removed.
But all due respect, I mean, people on all sides of the Middle East, conflicts within the Middle East, use all kinds of language to degrade and dehumanize the other side.
Okay.
The Israelis do it as well. The Palestinians do it. The Iranians do it. They all do it.
In all due respect,
right?
and I hate to invoke the Holocaust here, but I think one of the lessons of
Please
the Holocaust
don't.
Is when people talk about destroying you and say they're going to destroy you, you don't want to simply dismiss it as empty rhetoric, especially when it's a country like Iran, which is now getting the capability to do what its leaders are threatening to do.
Well, first of all, it's not getting the capability. It doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. We have to repeat that over and over and
well,
over again.
Well, how do you know that?
We saw it in the New York
Times,
Washington Post yesterday, reference to Iran's nuclear weapons program.
You don't know that at all. How can you be so certain
of that? It doesn't have one.
It's certain. Why does Iran, awash in oil and natural gas, spend tens of billions of dollars on developing nuclear fuel that it can buy in the open market at a fraction of the
price? Part of it is about respect. Let's be clear. The same reason that Israel has nuclear weapons. They want respect in the region, and like too many other countries, including our own, there's this false belief that somehow having nuclear weapons makes you more important for Israel.
No,
for Iran,
it's not about respect.
They want
it's about
control
having a life
over the process of
telling
producing
potential
one at a time.
That if they try and destroy you,
one at a time. Stephen, let's finish our statement. We can't hear both talking at the same time.
Iran has made clear that they want the right to control their own access to nuclear fuel. And they have agreed in the new agreement to complete inspection, 24/7 inspection of the entire nuclear fuel processing. That means everything from the mines where they might mine uranium to the processing of uranium into gas to the enrichment of uranium up to 3.5%. Keep in mind, weaponized uranium needs to go up to over 92%. Iran has never had anything except for one set of centrifuges that for a brief moment could get up to 20%, and that didn't last. But their machines are now limited to the production of 3.5% enrichment. That's what you need for nuclear power. That's what they're going to be allowed to produce. This isn't a nuclear weapons program.
Let me just ask this question. I think it's very quickly, Stephen, but I think we need to get back to the reality of what's happening in the U.S. Congress before we run out of time. Go ahead.
Well, the same enrichment capability that gets you to 3.5%, by spinning the nuclear gas additionally, will get you to 90%. In fact,
and that's why they're not going to be allowed to do it. They're having to cut back on the number of centrifuges down to 5,000 from 20,000. It's easier to get from 0.7% to 3%.
0.7% is where the uranium starts.
But let's deal with a couple of realities here. Let's talk about the reality of what's happening in the U.S. Congress. Let's say, for argument's sake, that The Republican majority and the folks with APAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and others have their way and win the battle. It's most likely that the vote in Congress will vote against the agreement, the nuclear agreement.
Right.
But then President Obama will veto it. It has to go back to the U.S. Congress. And at this point, it's really up to Democrats whether they're going to support the deal or not support the deal, support the president, not support the president. And if they do not support the president, if they override his veto and kill the deal, from what I understand, it means that the deal is gone, but that all the other nations that have already said that have put sanctions in place against Iran will no longer honor those sanctions, but will go ahead with their agreements with Iran.
Exactly.
I mean, what could be set up if this is not signed?
I think that what we're looking at is exactly what you just said, Mark. We're looking at a scenario where the U.S. would be even more isolated than it is now. There are no more negotiations. That's been very clear. You know, this notion that we hear from Republican candidates and others in the punditry, I would be stronger. I would go back and start the negotiations again. Well, I don't know who they think they're going to negotiate with. There's nobody left in Vienna. Everybody went home. The negotiations are over. That boat has sailed. This is the deal. The choice is between this deal and not a deal. It's not between this deal and some elusive better deal that would require an Iranian collapse, a complete, get down on your knees and say, I will do whatever you tell me. That's not going to happen. There are no more negotiations to be had. These 18 months of negotiations were it. The other countries are going to abide by the resolution. Hopefully, Iran would simply shake their collective heads and say, oh, the U.S. is out of control again. Why don't they even abide by what they say they're going to abide by? And they will ignore the U.S. as much as possible. The danger, of course, from as proposed by somebody like Carly Fiorini, who just said that she thinks it's a done deal in Congress. She doesn't think there's much Congress can do. But if she were to be elected president, the first thing she would do would be to ensure that Iran was not able to engage with the global banking system because, what a surprise, the U.S. dollar has a supreme role in the U.S., in the international banking system. And she would do that to ensure that Iran was isolated from the rest of the world. And you have to ask yourself, what would that do to U.S. relations with what would then be Iran's significant trading partners, places like Germany, Japan, the U.K., France, all of our allies who are eager to trade with Iran, to normalize relations with Iran? It would lead to a complete isolation of the U.S. diplomatically, and it would completely undermine the trust that any governments might still have in U.S. diplomacy.
Stephen, what are your thoughts on that? Different or the same?
Well, I must say, it's ironic in that some of my, as Mark, as you know, if I were in Congress, I would vote to support the agreement. And some of my biggest fights with my colleagues and others have been my decision that I think it's better to have this this agreement than not. Well, I must say, in listening to Phyllis's, I feel, exaggerated defense of this agreement, it's almost making me rethink my support of it.
Why?
Because I understand the opposition. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. You are, again, legitimizing a state to have a very large nuclear infrastructure that, even if it abides by the treaty, and after 10 years, it can break out, and even in President Obama's words, have a nuclear weapon almost immediately. And, you know, we can parse words, nuclear program, not nuclear program. If you have large numbers of centrifuges, you have the ability to enrich uranium to 90%, whether you call it for peaceful purposes or not. And virtually overnight, Iran can develop into a nuclear weapon state. And, I mean, the hope that I have is that if Iran engages in the international economic world, that its moderate population will prevail and these crazy mullahs will be shunted aside or at least moderated. And at the end of this, Iran will not be the threat that it is today. And my other concern is that no one has explained to me what Plan B is, that you have to lay out for me what walking away from the plan, how that puts us in a better situation. And to me, it doesn't. But that doesn't mean that this is a good treaty. My view, it's a bad treaty, but it's better than no treaty at all.
And perhaps we could agree that what's important is to make sure that Congress hears the voices of people who think this agreement, it's not a treaty, that this agreement must be supported. You know, Congress is under enormous pressure. AIPAC has put now 40 million, they originally said 20, now they've said 40 million, created a new organization, United Against Nuclear Iran, put in $40 million just for this 60-day period, and they are inundating every ad market. The Washington Post every day has full-page ads addressed to specific single members of Congress. It's a hugely powerful process, and I think it's important that everybody who recognizes, for whatever reason, whether you agree with all of it or don't agree with all of it, but recognize that supporting this agreement is important, needs to be engaged with members of Congress to make that clear.
Okay, AIPAC certainly has the right to do what it does, and I certainly hope, Phyllis, that you and others who have talked about the disproportionate influence of AIPAC and other pro-Israeli lobbies in the United States, I hope you and others, if this agreement does pass Congress, will acknowledge that perhaps AIPAC's power is not what it has been purported to be.
I think AIPAC power is way lower than it used to be.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
I've written about it.
But I hope.
I think it remains a hugely powerful lobby. It's not the most important. And luckily, and I'm very grateful, and I take a little bit of credit organizationally with all the people I work with in organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, who have worked very hard to diminish AIPAC's power, and I think they've had some success, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, certainly there is lobbying efforts on the other side as well.
It is true. They have raised less than $1 million.
Other groups,
let's be clear.
That are pushing for the approval of this agreement.
Absolutely, and that's where you have people pushing very,
simply,
very hard. There are people calling in the hundreds of thousands to their members of Congress. You don't have people donating $40 million. You do have people on the ground calling their own representatives
and
urging them.
Okay, but let's be clear here. AIPAC has people, too. There are a lot of good thinking people who are not motivated by money, who genuinely feel that this agreement is not in the interests of the United States. And I don't think it's right to even indirectly impugn their motives, too. There are good reasons to oppose this agreement. I don't feel that they should carry the day, but I don't impugn the motives of people who
I'm not impugning anybody's motives. I'm saying that when you have $40 million put in by one organization into a 60-day ad campaign, you're up against a really big chunk of money.
Okay.
And yeah, and we've had shows around AIPAC before, and we'll have more conversations with them on the air as well. And I think it's important to note that when the polls have shown interestingly enough, that the one community in America where the majority of people support the deal in Iran, other than the African American and other Latino communities, is the Jewish community that support the deal.
And even
Mark,
more
I
than the American people overall.
It's important to note that Jews and much of AIPAC money has been associated with the Democratic Party. But it's the Republicans who are lockstep against this agreement. And my guess is they're going to get near unanimous opposition to this agreement in the Republican Party. So the notion that somehow this is AIPAC simply pulling strings ignores the fact that there's a large constituency in this country that opposes this treaty that has nothing to do with AIPAC.
That's certainly true. But it's also true that AIPAC often claims to represent the Jewish community, which supports this deal. The latest poll I saw is 63% of Jews support it, 54% of the American public as a whole support it. So AIPAC is completely out of line with the constituency they claim to represent.
So the two of you are always wonderful in this program together because you bring really interesting viewpoints that are different, but also in many ways attached. So I think it's really important for us to be able to wrestle with this in this manner.
Thanks, Mark. As I told you, I do have to leave for another one.
No, we're ending this now anyway because we have another program that I appreciate it. Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her latest book is Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. And Dr. Stephen David, who's professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, whose most recent book is Catastrophic Consequences, Civil Wars and American Interest. Stephen and Phyllis, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
We're going to take a quick break and come right back, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And coming up on the Mark Steiner Show in the next hour, we discuss the upsurge of violence in Baltimore with Baltimore activist, poet, and writer Avon Bellamy, OSI's Tara Huffman, and others joining us as we talk about what's going on in Baltimore, where we've now experienced 208 homicides. It's only August the 18th. And over 2014, Baltimore experienced less homicides. What's going on? What can we do to address it? We'll discuss that when we return. Stay with us.